Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we've got Dr. Amberine Mehta, palliative care physician and assistant professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. She joined the show to discuss palliative care and its evolving role in the paradigm for patients with chronic neurologic disease, as well as its history in the United States, how it differs from hospice care, and a little bit more. So without further ado, let's dive in.
My name is Amberine Mehta. I am a palliative care physician at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center, and I see patients with in palliative care and in the ALS clinic here. So palliative care really is a focus on quality of life for patients and their families or their loved ones, really who have life-limiting illnesses. And these life-limiting illnesses often affect all the parts of your human being, your physical, emotional, psychosocial, spiritual, financial components. And the whole purpose of palliative care is to minimize suffering. And that is really why we care for the whole person. And really, when we talk about palliative care, we think about it as an approach. And so it's care provided by pretty much anyone in the healthcare field. So we sometimes differentiate it by saying primary palliative care versus specialty palliative care. I'm a palliative care specialist because I did a hospice and palliative medicine fellowship, which, by the way, you can do after any specialty. So that's why there are neurologists doing palliative care fellowships. There are cardiologists. I've had surgical, even residents, but after their long-time career of in the surgical field, come and do a palliative care fellowship with me. And it's really just because, and some people continue to practice their primary specialty, and then some people decide, hey, I've either want to do a whole secondary career as a palliative care doc and want to give up my primary specialty, or they kind of figure out a really cool way to combine the two, which we can talk about later, but there's a lot of neurologists in the field now doing a very cool combination of the two specialties, and putting both of their training programs in the highlight of their work daily, which is a really cool progression in the field. And primary palliative care, it's done by not just physicians. It's literally done by anybody who's providing an improvement in quality of life for a person who has an illness. And that's everything from the person in a hospital cleaning the room, or a nurse at bedside, or the primary care doctor, and the social workers. So that's why we have a real focus in palliative care of multidisciplinary care. It's very, very important. And not every team has that luxury, but when they do, that is the model of care for palliative care. It is really different from hospice care, which I'm very transparent about with my patients. The first thing I tell them is, I'm not hospice care. I can help you decide if and when that is right for you, which could be now or it could be many decades from now. But there is a lot of concern or confusion amongst our patients, amongst our colleagues, that it's the same thing. And that comes from a little bit of the history of how palliative care as a field developed.
So what is that history? Because I think that, that's an important distinction to make, the difference between those two. And it's interesting because, as you kind of learn that distinction, palliative care and the idea of it and how to incorporate it, particularly, you know, for neurologic disease, where we're talking about chronic disease that patients are going to have for a very long time. You know, it's like you said, it may not be, hospice may not be something they need until years and years, perhaps even decades down the line. But the model that palliative care kind of operates in really seems to line up very well with this sort of more holistic treatment model that we're seeing a lot of institutions and sort of large organizations kind of push the field in the direction of, and a lot of clinicians are very receptive to that. So for you, I mean, what are kind of those key differences that maybe some of the practicing clinicians out there, whether they be APCs or physicians, you know, that maybe they're not super aware of, or there's still kind of some misunderstandings about?
Yeah. And this is where I'm going to share a little bit of like the actual history with you, because I think it really helped me to understand where did hospice begin, and then where did palliative begin? Because palliative is a younger field than hospice care. So, you know, to make it really, really simple, hospice is a Medicare benefit. And in 1986, Congress created this Medicare hospice benefit. And it actually is what established palliative care in the health system, but it was very limited to hospice care. And hospice care is really defined as the focus of comfort as the number one priority for somebody's healthcare when they have a prognosis of 6 months or less. And if you just take that one definition, I think that's where a lot of people worry that, well, I'm not at 6 months of life or less. And so my patient isn't ready for hospice. And so my patient isn't ready for palliative care. And what really is important is the kind of part of it that really defines when I talk to patients about whether hospice is right for them or not at a certain point is really whether their philosophy of care and priorities has changed. And it's within that framework, again, of quality of life. So if their philosophy of care changes to maximize comfort over other life prolonging therapies, then hospice might be the right fit for them, because it's going to improve that quality of life. But when patients still have life prolonging treatments that they want to receive, and they still need comfort in order to get through those treatments, and it still fits in their, you know, whatever they define as their goals of care at that time, that is where kind of we really start to see the differences between palliative care and hospice care. In the United States, palliative care in the 19th century, actually, so there were these medical writings that discussed the role of physicians in easing the dying process. And that's where the word palliative was used to describe this role of easing suffering. And there was actually an increase in the number of deaths in the hospital, and homes for the dying were opened up across Europe. And so they really separated out dying from, you know, the dying process from happening in the hospital. They kind of tried to get it out of the hospital into these homes. In the mid-1950s, they did these three major studies, and those studies showed that there was a lot of ongoing mental and physical suffering. And there were a lot of poor conditions of patients dying at home and in these charitable homes. So it really raised alarm that people weren't dying the way that they thought that these homes would help, or that they thought that, you know, by separating out this field of maybe palliative or hospice, that it would do that. It didn't really seem to accomplish that. And this woman, Cicely Saunders, who later was given the title of a dame, she was the founder of the field of palliative care at that time. And she developed this new concept of the care of the dying. And that was this concept of holistic care, where, you know, you have the medical, social, and spiritual issues should all be considered. And her work actually is what developed into the modern hospice. So you can see this history of the word palliative was used to describe the suffering, but the formation of hospice was almost an artificial separation from hospital to home. And it really is in other countries, especially in the UK and Europe and other countries, palliative is kind of synonymous to hospice, but that is because in the US, this Medicare hospice benefit was created to separate out the two. So as opposed to being a nice kind of transition across time, transition across care goals, here in our country, we separate them out. The word of hospice was changed to palliative care in the Western world, in Montreal, in Canada, actually, in 1976. And it actually was developed that way to suit the language in the region. And then palliative care came to the US in the 1960s. So it's really young. And in the 1990s, the World Health Organization actually recognized palliative care as a distinct specialty. So it took a very long time across many different continents and countries to actually separate out these terms.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound like there is, you know, there is kind of a clear, like you're saying, it's almost like a transition, right? You kind of would, you know, especially I would imagine in terms of, you know, neurologic disease, you would kind of transition from a sort of palliative model into potentially, say, a hospice model. But they are very clearly sort of intertwined. So I would see how, you know, that can add a little bit of confusion, especially when we talk about the definitions across, you know, in Europe, say, versus the United States. And I'm curious, you know, again, because we talked a little bit about, you know, again, how these things are different. And I do wonder, you know, the neurology community specifically, there's clearly a need for this. There's a huge increased focus in the last couple of years on improving quality of life, really getting the patient involved in shared decision making. And it sounds like that's kind of a staple of palliative care, is establishing, you know, what are the patient's needs and desires for this care model? And then how do we execute on those and kind of make that so? So for you, I mean, it seems like there's a natural fit in neurology or in chronic neurologic disease, but for you, what's kind of that role that palliative care can play? You know, for the neurologists who are treating, say, these patients with, you know, terminal or chronic illnesses, how might this improve their care practice, or how might incorporating some of these tenets of palliative care, you know, improve their ability to help their patient?
Absolutely. I think that this is, and when you're asking about, you know, the care that the neurologist can provide in terms of the palliative care, needs that their patients have, right? That's that primary palliative care we're thinking about. And neurologic disorders are very unique in that they have a number of high symptoms, right? So they have unique symptoms from things like seizures and things like altered mental status, and ones that actually have a lot of limitations on the communication of these people and affect their ability to understand, or what we call complicated medical decision-making processes, where maybe they, for example, a patient who's had a stroke that's affected their language are maybe completely unable to communicate what they want and are aware and are exactly involved in what's going on, but they can't even find the right, they can speak even, but they can't find the right words. Or like in my patient population of ALS, where they can no longer speak, but they're, you know, cognition is completely intact. And then there are patients who have a lot of neurologic diseases, have a very prolonged decline in their disease trajectory. You know, for example, dementia can be decades, and that leads to really high care part, like the loved ones that they have, their care partners, they have a lot of needs that put a lot of burden on their care partners for a very long time. So we're looking at a lot of caregiver distress and need for their mental health care as well. And then probably some of the most stressful components of neurologic diseases is that they have a lot of prognostic uncertainty. And so that makes it really complicated to make decisions about their care, because even the smartest, most experienced neurologists, they don't they aren't necessarily able to tell the families or the patients what's going to happen or when to expect it. And, you know, so in ALS, for example, we know what is going to happen. We even know many of the major steps and decisions that need to be made, but we just don't know when. When do they need to make them?
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Mehta to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, the FDA has accepted a new drug application for trofinetide, formerly known as NNZ-2566, an investigational treatment for Rett syndrome from Acadia Pharmaceuticals, and has set a Prescription Drug User Fee Act action date of March 12, 2023 for the review of the application. Additionally, the announcement from Acadia noted that the agency did not request an advisory committee meeting for the therapy. Next, after previously showing higher potential in trial data as a monotherapy, Athira Pharma announced it was amending its ongoing pivotal LIFT-AD trial to assess its investigational agent fosgenamenoton as such in patients with Alzheimer's disease without background ACHEI inhibitors. According to the update, an independent unblinded interim analysis will be conducted to inform the required sample set will be needed to appropriately power the primary endpoint target patient population. Finally, Pasithea Therapeutics announced positive results from a preclinical proof-of-concept study of PAS-002, its tolerizing vaccine that is being developed in a program for multiple sclerosis. The study's findings shown that the glial cell adhesion molecule found in the brain's white matter is attacked in MS, with data suggesting that there was a relapsing paralysis established in a mouse model of relapsing-remitting experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Mehta.
Yeah, and I imagine a lot of these patient populations, there's a lot of heterogeneity too. So every patient, you know, that timeline is going to be different. I'm actually really curious, you know, because when you mention some of these patient populations, like those with dementia or even ALS, where there's a care partner involved, because that's another area where we've seen a lot of attention get focused in the last decade or so on really making sure that this isn't just sort of a dyad relationship between the physician and the patient, but it's more of a triad where it's the physician, the patient, and the caregiver. And you know, it's kind of like a team effort within that small group. You know, how can palliative care help in that instance? Because we talk a lot about caregiver burden and the difficulties in, you know, helping to care for these patients. And obviously everyone's goal in that process is to improve the patient's quality of life and hopefully their prognostic outcome. But, you know, are there potential sort of downstream, I guess, benefits of palliative care for even these sort of secondary, I guess, players, you know, not the patient themselves?
Absolutely. So we have, you know, one is that we palliative care, like I was kind of describing, is we're a multidisciplinary team. So a lot of times we're lucky to have a social work or a chaplain to give additional support. And some of it is also that we can dedicate the space and the time of our visits into providing this additional layer of support for the care partners to explore and talk and process what is happening for them in the setting of what's happening to their loved one. In these conversations that we have as in palliative care, we do a lot of goals of care conversations and discussions about kind of how to prepare and what to expect in the setting of we're lucky in the sense that what our communication skills help us do is hold a space of uncertainty. And being comfortable with uncertainty allows for exploration of the hard decisions that could possibly be needing to be made or may never need to be made, but at least the discussion of it allows for people to start putting it out there in a space that's safe and, applying it to the medical decisions that need to be made, which is which is a little bit of therapy, you know, in a technical sense, right? But the medical physician background that I have, for example, helps me to also connect it to the medical decisions that they have to make. And me having a social work behavioral therapist or chaplain on my team helps to then also provide that necessary therapy that in partnership.
Yeah. I mean, and it sounds like, again, you know, if, especially if you have the resource available to you, you know, if you're a physician who's located in sort of one of these larger institutions where there may be a palliative care specialist or even a department available for you. I'm sure for the community neurologist, it might be a little more difficult to access some of those resources, but, you know, maybe for those who are interested in trying to identify someone like that. I mean, I know, again, to what you mentioned earlier, there's ways to sort of go through this training on your own. But for you, I mean, what are kind of your recommendations, you know, for, I guess, again, you know, accessing that as a resource or at least getting some level of information? And then on the timing, you know, if you encounter a patient who could be potentially a candidate for this, or, I mean, is there a way you identify like who is the right, you know, and how early? Is this something it's like, hey, I'm seeing this patient with Parkinson for the first time. Let's see if we can rope in palliative care. And, you know, is that something right at the beginning of the process? Is it something that goes later on? I know I asked you several questions.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, so the short answer is it's never too early to consult palliative care as a specialty. That being said, as you said, sometimes the resources are really scarce and patients have no access, especially depending on where they are in the country or internationally. And so, there's work being done through societies like the International Neuropalliative Care Society. There's work being done by the American Academy of Neurology and the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, just to name a few. There are international ones out there. For example, there's one in Colombia, and then there's a European one that's the EAPC. So there's different palliative care groups, national societies, and neurological societies that are working to make at least some national resources available through the internet. A lot of us are trying to be connected and make a lot of these resources available online, or even just making a network for each other to have access, things like Neurology Live and, you know, being on podcasts like this. The other part of that is that a lot of, you know, the field of palliative care, so neuropalliative is the field of palliative care for neurological illnesses, right? And so the field of neuropalliative care in and of itself is more about the recognition of palliative care for neurological illnesses. But there's been work on this by a lot of people for a long time. And it's only more recently becoming formalized and having more data available. So I don't think we don't have, there are triggers. People have done studies on triggers, for example, to say, these are for a specific disease, to say, you know, if you meet these criteria, you should call a palliative care specialist. But that doesn't exist for a lot of diseases. I think when the care is getting complicated, so the example I use when I teach my residents is, or my learners is, I use the example of hypertension. So many primary care doctors, even neurologists, can manage basic hypertension. But when you're needing two or three medications, or, you know, you need a test done, then you send someone to a cardiologist. So in this scenario, you know, in the equivalency for neurological illnesses, many neurologists are doing palliative care already. They're providing a lot of symptom medications like seizure medications for seizures, or, talking about goals of care in regards to putting a feeding tube in or something like that, right? All of those are palliative care services and ones that we hope through education and resources, we can empower neurologists to do even more of when the symptoms get too complicated, or they're having a lot of existential distress, or the family is really There's like many, for example, maybe there's distress amongst the family and there's arguments going on about how to proceed next. What are the goals? That's when, especially if you don't have easy access to a palliative care doctor, you might say, well, this is a need that I need to actually go and find some help for. And if there isn't anybody in your near vicinity, then hopefully kind of either through the extensive networks or online, kind of having a phone a friend remotely. And there's a lot of virtual work being done nowadays as well, which has been helpful.
Oh yeah. I mean, I imagine, you know, again, you know, speaking of like the INPCS, you know, just having a place to go where you can access a network or someone and just maybe something as simple as hopping on a Zoom call to get a bit of insight. And I want to ask, you know, because as I'm sure you're very well aware, obviously the medical community loves evidence-based medicine. So for you, I mean, what is, you know, are there some sort of resources? And I know in the show notes for this, we're going to have a ton of references for people to take a look at. But for you, know, what's kind of the available evidence? Because it does seem like, again, there's kind of a natural, you know, put one and two together type thing going on here in neurology, where a lot of these patient populations would clearly benefit, and a lot of physicians too would benefit, just in terms of the ability to really improve the status of their patients. But what's some of the evidence as far as the non, you know, just how it benefits patient quality of life, whether it's sort of costs or outcome improvements, you know, those kind of other you know, potential pros of introducing palliative care into the equation.
Yeah. So the, you know, all the data that have been done there, there are data that have looked at a variety of different diseases across different settings. So for example, in the neurocritical care world, there have been studies that show that when a palliative care, they partnered the neurocritical care teams and they partnered with the palliative care team, you know, and when they do that, you can get improvement in the number of goals of care conversations that happen. They've shown that there's a decrease in the length of stay in the hospital, which then decreased costs. They actually found that mortality did not increase. So it wasn't like palliative care doctors were going around saying, you know, no care for anybody, everybody should just die. And that, you know, we often have this, there's a cartoon of a palliative care docs walking down the hallway as the, you know, as the death with the sickle. And, you know, that, you know, there have been numerous studies, not just in the neurocritical care unit, but in other, in general ICU settings, in clinics, that have shown that mortality does not increase with the involvement of palliative care. Cost savings as well have been, and you know, I did a study with looking at a large data set of patients, for example, with stroke, and found that cost does not increase with the involvement of palliative care, even though it's another specialty being involved. And overall satisfaction of patients increases. And that's, for example, they did these studies with patients who have multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disorder, Parkinson's disease, motor neuron disorders. So it's across multiple different types of neurological illnesses that they've shown. And I'm kind of combining a number of the results from different papers that we'll have in the links, as you said, but just kind of generally have the data do support across different diseases. It's not necessarily just one or the other. Traditionally, palliative care has been linked to cancer, and neuro-oncology has taken up palliative care quite robustly. And you know, it's same holding there as well, but I think some of the leaders in the field are trying to understand the, like you said, the timing, the value of adding extra services for these patients. And it seems to be holding up. Of course, more studies do need to be done to understand and really question, do you need a palliative care specialist, as you asked? Can these services be done by the neurology teams? And if they can be done, which we know they're being done, it's just a matter of how are they done? How well are they done? What's the difference? Is it enough? You know, does it provide good enough care?
Yeah. And I think clearly that's where the role of some of these organizations that you mentioned, kind of what the role that they play. And I know, again, you know, one that we've mentioned a couple of times now, the IMPCS has, you know, an annual meeting now where everybody kind of gets together to discuss these things. So, I mean, for you as someone who has some experience with those societies, you know, what's your advice, I guess, for someone who's perhaps interested in learning more, or maybe again, like looking to perhaps get certified in some way to provide this care, or at least standardize the way they do so? You know, what are your recommendations in terms of getting involved or just learning a little bit more about what's going on?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think it depends on your background, right? So the American Academy of Neurology and the American Academy for Hospice and Palliative Medicine. And this is I recognize that, you know, these two specific organizations are US based. And there are many wonderful palliative care societies internationally. And I can't name them all, but we partner with a lot of them. I will say that the International Neuropalliative Care Society, what is really cool about it is that it is trying to be a central location for a lot of these services that the AAN and the AAHPM and some of these other societies right now have as small parts of their society. The other really cool part about it is that, and I'm part of multiple organizations, so I'm not only, you know, I don't want to just be partial to the IMPCS, but why it's unique is that it really is taking a multidisciplinary approach where patients, care partners, social workers, chaplains, physicians, health advocates are all working in the same space. I mean, we have a number of people on the leadership side in that organization. Unlike physician-led organizations like maybe the AAN, where their leadership is a little bit more doctor-centric, which is important, the International Neuropalliative Care Society has this multidisciplinary approach, which is what's needed, I think, going forward. And hopefully will, and it's international, which is also the most important, you know, for all of our education and for upcoming work. And so, you know, with this creation of this, the hope is that it can serve as a central hub for a lot of the resources without having to pay too much or having to be a member. Like, I'm not a member of the American Academy of Neurology, can only pay so many dues every year. But I think that where I get my access to my neurology colleagues is through these kind of other organizations. And I think when we, you know, through that, there has been a number of different educational things that have come about, like the end of life palliative education curriculum, EPEC, through University of Northwestern, did a number of modules on that. It is a full curriculum of palliative education intended to be directed towards neurologists. And it's all for free on the IMPCS website, for example. So you can take that and implement it or read it yourself. There's an international curriculum that has also been developed and a certification course that can be done. There are talks like things like Vital Talk, which is being done, which you know, costs money, but is available to learn communication styles. And there's a number of certification courses through some of these associations for non-physicians, you know, for nurses and for social workers who like there's like LNEC. LNEC is another educational course for nurses specifically. The social work SWPHN, it's SWPHN, it's the Social Work Palliative and Hospice Network for social workers who are interested in palliative care. So a lot of these resources and organizations have free education, have free trainings that people can go to learn more about palliative care without having to make that their entire job.
Yeah, which I'm sure is, you know, very, because again, when we talk, you know, specifically in the neuro community, you know, and every specialty is kind of feeling that burden of, you know, minimal amount of time with patients, minimal amount of time and opportunity to sort of maximize what you're doing with those patients. So free resources and just access. And again, to speak to that multidisciplinary model, you know, you're seeing that with a lot of these meetings too, with, you know, societal meetings for disease specific groups, you know, on a smaller scale that maybe aren't as large as the American Academy of Neurology, where you have these limitations on how much focus you can give to one segment of care. But you're starting to see a lot of these meetings do that INPCS model where you incorporate the patient community. And I think that just speaks, it's almost like a microcosm of what the field is doing is, you know, we're trying to have these shared decision-making processes. It makes sense to have everybody in the same room at the same time. So the last thing I wanted to ask you, and of course, if there's anything else you think is important to add, you know, the floor is yours, but the last thing I want to ask you is just, again, because this is such kind of a new, you know, it's a young field, relatively speaking, but there is kind of a clear, I think, need for it or a fit for it. You know, what's, I guess, your elevator pitch to the, say, the community neurologist or the MS specialist who's, you know, they're busy, but they could potentially find benefit from this. You know, what's your pitch to them to try to reach out to maybe access some of these resources or to get involved in one of these societies or something like that, just to potentially get a little bit more palliative care into their care paradigm?
I would say, you know, remembering that the focus is quality of life. And if you see that there is a potential to improve that quality of life, either yourself or with the help of one of the colleagues, you know, that you work with, if it's a palliative care specialist, whether it's a physician or a chaplain or social work, or even the patients and care partners, not to hesitate to explore that. It doesn't mean you have to do it yourself. As you said, everyone is really, really busy and we need doctors. So we tell patients that there are a lot of doctors who are going to help you feel better and get better, but palliative care can help them really focus on feeling better. And we need care partners, right? One is not better than the other. It's just that we need care partners to do both to improve that quality of life. So, you know, don't hesitate. Don't worry about if it's too early or you're not sure or whatever it is. Don't worry about that. Reaching out, working as a collaborative team, that is the most important thing to make things better for your patient and for you and for the rest of your team as well, actually. You know, I think for the folks who don't have so many resources available to them in terms of the clinical care part, there has been an explosion of books and publications that for most people should be easily findable. If you type in neuropalliative care, there's at least two textbooks that have been published. And if you look in PubMed and just type in the word neuropalliative care, the graph of publications has just become exponential. And many of them are helpful guides, not necessarily nitty-gritty details of research. So I would encourage people to use those resources as well.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.